questions and comments. Now, any of you that would like to give a question or a comment, I would appreciate it if you could come up here to the microphone so that we can hear your question. If you want to give your question or comment from the audience here, then you'll just have to be satisfied with my summary of what you have to say, and I may garble and completely misinterpret what you're saying. So if you want to be quoted directly, then quote yourself and come up here. And please be brief with your comments so that others may have the opportunity to make their suggestions. Clay Chandler is an architect and developer with the Chandler and Associates in Downington, Pennsylvania, which I understand is near Philadelphia. He's given several talks before at the Sunstone Symposium, one of them on architecture and the LDS Church, entitled Understanding Mormon Architecture from a Historical Perspective, which I heard many years ago, which was very good. And the other one was Correlation, the Boring of a Generation, which also is very interesting. 30 years ago next month, I moved into the Monument Park 8th Ward, the Foothill Village area. They immediately put me in as a teacher of the priest quorum, and I stayed in that position for over 4 years. At that time, we had about 100 members of the Aaronic priesthood in our ward, and so there were many, many priests in my class. After I'd been in about 2 years, there was a young 15-year-old boy that came into my class, and I'd had pretty much free rein for the previous 2 years. I could say almost anything I wanted to, and the boys would either accept it or be indifferent toward it or be more concerned about basketball. But not Clay Chandler. I'd go blithely along, and then Clay would say, "Well, now, wait a minute, Brother Vernon, is that really true? What about this, and what about that? Have you considered this? Have you considered that?" And I was taken aback from this young upstart that was challenging the authority of an all-wise, all-knowledgeable teacher. So anyway, Clay sent me back to the drawing boards and was one of the factors that contributed to my later and ever since continuing research into Mormon history and doctrine. So I thank Clay for bringing me up short and getting me into this more than I had been before, into this fascinating field. And Clay's family still lives in our ward. Clay received his Bachelor of Arts in Business from the University of Utah, his Master's in Architecture from the University of Pennsylvania, and I understand he's written and directed many award-winning road shows and proudly teaches Sunday school for 15-year-olds and manages to keep them interested in spite of the fact that he uses the manual. So that's quite an achievement. As you can see, he's a man of many achievements. D. Michael Quinn, I'm sure, is known to most of us. In my opinion, he's one of the best, most thorough, comprehensive, and exhaustive of all Mormon historians. And if any of you listened to my comments on Mormon creeds yesterday, you'll know that one of my creeds is, please tell me the whole story, not just part of it. And that's why I think people need to come, they're interested in Mormon history and doctrine, need to come to Sunstone to get the whole story that they don't otherwise get. Mike was born in Pasadena, California, raised in Glendale, served a mission to England from 1963 to 65. He received his bachelor's degree from BYU in 1968 in English and philosophy, two subjects that my son received his bachelor's in about 3 years ago from the University of Utah. Two factors that qualify him among the ones that I just mentioned specifically for today's topic are as follows. From 1969 to 71, he was involved in military counterintelligence in Munich, Germany, where I served a mission, where he inventoried all top secret documents. And the second, of course, was his famous dialogue article on post-manifesto polygamy. He's since his earliest years, he's had a hobby He started out with a hobby in LDS history, but he later elevated that to a profession, and of course we're all grateful for that. He received his master's from the University of Utah in history in 1973, his PhD in history in 1976 from Yale, and as we all know, from 1976 to 1988, he was a history professor at BYU. In 1993, the True Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints excommunicated him for telling the truth about LDS history. Mainly, I understand, for his article on post-manifesto polygamy and his article in indicating that many church leaders, early church leaders, believe that endowed women have the priesthood. At least that was the catalyst. He's an author of several books and articles. The articles, except for the ones that I've mentioned, are too numerous to list, but four of his most famous books are Early Mormonism and the Magic Worldview, which is out of print, but I understand he's revising it and will turn in his final manuscript to the publishers in September. Another book that we're all familiar with, which generated much controversy, was Same-Sex Dynamics Among 19th Century Americans, A Mormon Example. And of course, his two big magnum opuses, if there's such a word, Mormon Hierarchy, Volume 1, Origins of Power, and Volume 2, Extensions of Power, both of which I would highly recommend to you. Their most fascinating look at what goes on behind the scenes in Mormon history. So, without any further ado, we'll turn the balance of the time over to these two fine gentlemen.
I want to thank Bob for that introduction. I'll give him credit for being one of the best examples of a teacher, actually, that I ever had, because he was the only one that no matter what question I asked, he would try to answer it. Not usually that week. Usually he would go research it. But by the next week, he was standing there with an answer, and I always appreciated that, and when I teach Sunday school, I try to do the same thing. In October of 1993, Dallin H. Oaks, an apostle for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and Steve Benson, editorial cartoonist for the Arizona Republic and eldest grandson of former president of the church, Ezra Taft Benson, had an argument in a public place. Their dispute centered on the role played by Apostle Boyd K. Packer in the September excommunication of Paul James Toscano, and according to both men, this had been the subject of a discussion between them during two confidential meetings. It was witnessed by hundreds of thousands of people across the nation as they opened their newspapers and saw headlines like, Cartoonist says leader lied to protect fellow apostle, and Oaks, I've been the victim of double-decker deceit. Benson replies, charges Oaks with dissembling. These two men obviously had very different interpretations of shared experiences. As an outside observer, it is not possible for me to determine exactly what transpired between them. This thing's humming. I wonder if I can fix that. One or both of them may have lied. One or both of them may have been intentionally deceptive. One or both of them may have been deceptive while fully believing that they were being completely truthful. The veracity of their statements, while important, is less intriguing to me than the fact that an apostle of the Church of Jesus Christ was accused of lying to protect a fellow apostle. It's difficult to believe that an apostle, a special witness for Christ, would lie. It doesn't fit the image of a man of God. But could there be times when a prophet or an apostle might need to lie, might be justified in lying? We all know that politicians lie, governments lie, tobacco companies lie. But is it okay for religious leaders to lie? And if so, under what circumstances? And what effect does that have on their followers? My intention today is not to point fingers or to place blame, but to deal in a straightforward manner with the very touchy subject of truth and deception. Perhaps we should start by trying to define a few things. Webster's Third New International Dictionary defines truth as relationship, conformity, or agreement with fact or reality. And it defines a lie as, one, to make an untrue statement with intent to deceive, and two, to create a false or misleading impression. Lying is just one form of the much larger category known as deception. One can deceive without lying, but the intent of lying is always to deceive. There is, for example, a difference between telling a story I know to be false and telling a true story, but selectively omitting details to alter the listener's perception of the truth. The first is lying, the second, deception. The logical place to begin my examination was in the scriptures, but I soon learned that the scriptures dealing with lying invariably take an absolutist position. In Leviticus we read, "You shall not steal, neither deal falsely, neither lie one with another." In the New Testament, Paul wrote to the Ephesians, "Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we are members one of another." In 2 Nephi, in the Book of Mormon, "Woe unto the liar, for he shall be thrust down to hell." And then in 3 Nephi, Christ speaks of the time when Israel shall be gathered and the lost tribes return, and he says, "And it shall come to pass that all lyings and deceivings and envyings and strifes and priestcrafts and whoredoms shall be done away." Finally, in the Doctrine of Covenants, we are told, "Who will inherit the celestial kingdom, the lowest of the three heavenly degrees of glory? These are they who are liars and sorcerers and adulterers and whoremongers and whosoever loves and makes a lie." Against the backdrop of those prophetic statements, I would also like to quote the unprophetic but deeply insightful Oscar Wilde, "The pure and simple truth is rarely pure and never simple." The absolute prohibition against lying found in the scriptures seems simple and clear until one starts examining the issue more closely and asking questions like, is truthfulness a unique moral value? How does it compare with other moral values like compassion, charity, discretion, friendship? Do we have a right to the truth from others? What would a world be like wherein everyone told all the truth all the time? And would we want to live in a world like that? If the truth be told, I'm more of an architect developer than a philosopher, and the answers to these questions are probably best left to professionals. Unsatisfied with the absolute prohibitions of the scriptures, I reviewed the works of several authors regarding the moral ambiguity of deception. David Nyberg, in his book The Varnished Truth, divides the predominant theories into two camps, which he calls top-down and bottom-up. The absolutists he places in the top-down category. Examples of absolutists include Immanuel Kant, who stated that truthfulness is the formal duty of an individual to everyone, however great may be the disadvantage accruing to himself or to another. Thus, the definition of a lie is merely an intentional, untruthful declaration to another person does not require the additional condition that it must harm another. For a lie always, if not some other particular man, still it harms mankind generally, for it vitiates the source of law itself. Another absolutist, Socrates, wanted all poets and storytellers banned from Athens because he believed their fictions and myths would confuse children about the truth, and that if they were ever to learn to distinguish between truth and fiction, they would have to first unlearn what they had learned. Cicela Bock, in her influential book, Lying, Moral Choice in Public and Private Life, puts forth a top-down theory that is absolutist in nature, while it recognizes that there must be occasional exceptions to the rule. She, like Kant, believes that lies are intrinsically harmful, not only to the deceived, but also to the liars themselves and to society in general. In the following passage, she explains how lies can harm society in the same way a virus can infect and destroy a body. Quote, "Even if liars make the effort to estimate the consequences to individuals, themselves and others, of their lies, they often fail to consider the many ways in which deception can spread and give rise to practices very damaging in human communities. These practices clearly do not affect only isolated individuals. The veneer of social trust is often very thin. As lies spread by imitation or in retaliation, or to forestall suspected deception, trust is damaged. Yet trust is a social good to be protected just as much as the air we breathe or the water we drink. When it is damaged, the community as a whole suffers. And when it is destroyed, societies falter and collapse." Bock does acknowledge that there may be occasional exceptions to this prohibition. "I have to agree that there are at least some circumstances which warrant a lie, and foremost among those is where innocent lives are at stake and where only a lie can deflect danger. But in taking such a position, it would be wrong to lose the profound concern which the absolutist theologians and philosophers express, the concern for the harm to trust and to oneself from lying, quite apart from any immediate effects from any one lie." End quote. In addition to avoiding harm, other possible excuses for dissembling include producing benefits, fairness, or veracity. However, she cautions, none of these excuses are accessible if the liar knew of a truthful alternative to secure the benefit, avoid the harm, or protect fairness. Even if a lie saves a life, it is unwarranted if the liar was aware that a truthful statement could have done the same. Finally, Bach distinguishes between two types of lies, excusable lies and justifiable lies. Justifiable lies not only must be excusable because they avoid harm, produce benefits, fairness, or veracity, but they must also be defensible as just, right, or proper by providing adequate reasons. It means to hold up some standard, such as religious or legal or moral standard. Such justification requires an audience. It may be directed to God or a court of law or one's peers or one's own conscience. But in ethics, it is most appropriately aimed not at all one individual or audience, but rather at reasonable persons in general. So, in other words, for a lie to be justifiable, it must, one, have been used as a last resort where no truthful alternative is possible. Two, it must be morally excusable. And three, it must be justifiable by some standard, be it in the eyes of God, in the eyes of a judge or a jury, or in the eyes of a public of reasonable persons. I'd like to give some examples of justifiable deceit, but first let me point out that there are eight basic ways to deceive. The first four involve active participation on the part of the deceiver. It's a little complicated, and I'm giving examples, a brief example of each. The first one, contribute to causing someone to acquire a false belief. Okay, this is straightforward lying. Straightforward lying is always in this category. That silver object you saw up in the sky was an Air Force weather balloon. It wasn't really a U-2 spy plane, if for those of you who saw that headline last week. Two, contribute to causing someone to continue in a false belief. Well, of course it's a low-mileage car. You saw the speedometer, didn't you? Three, contribute to causing someone to stop believing something that is true. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit. Four, contribute to causing someone to be unable to believe something that is true. This is called hiding the truth. We're not at all disappointed with the domestic ticket sales. This movie was aimed at the foreign market. Okay, the next four are more passive error of omission types of deception. Five, choose to allow someone to acquire a false belief. People would be shocked to find out that my ring is cubic zirconia. When they ask me if it's real, I just wink and smile. Six, choose to allow someone to continue in a false belief. When they ask me how much it costs, I just say, you don't want to know. Seven, choose to allow someone to stop believing something that is true. I was a witness to the crime, but I was afraid to testify, and as a result, the defendant was acquitted. Eight, choose to allow someone to go on without a true belief. When they come to look at the house, don't tell them that the basement floods unless they ask. I should mention that there is one other form of deception. It's known as self-deception and has been described as skillful maneuvering to achieve ignorance when clear conscious understanding threatens to break through. When we do and say things that are incongruent with our values, this can cause cognitive dissonance, which sometimes results in guilt, but can also result in our upholding one value and repressing the other. Through self-deception, it is possible to be deceptive and yet be completely convinced that one is being totally honest. There are a few times when it is almost universally agreed that one should engage in deceit. One example would be war. The following is from Sun Tzu's The Art of War. Quote, "All warfare is based on deception. Hence, when able to attack, we must seem unable. When using our forces, we must seem inactive. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe that we are far away, and when far away, we must make him believe we are near." End quote. During Desert Storm, General Norman Schwarzkopf used deception to trick the Iraqi army into believing the ground forces would be making a frontal assault from the south. The actual ground assault came from the west. The Iraqi army, which was without air reconnaissance at the time, was fooled by cardboard replicas of tanks, which included heat-emitting devices that mimicked the heat signatures of a tank on the Iraqis' infrared scanners. Similar deception was used in World War II to disguise the actual landing location for D-Day. Such deception can save lives and ensure victory. The object of war, to paraphrase George Patton, is not to die for your country, but to get your enemy to die for his country. Another place where deception is generally considered acceptable is national security. Many governments have spies. The CIA is a government-run spy organization, and many of its employees are good, faithful Mormons. We accept the necessity of spying to protect our national interests. Other examples of deception, allowable deception, excusable, justifiable deception, include the police being allowed to lie to suspects in order to persuade them to confess to their crimes, and doctors giving placebos to patients with incurable or non-existent illnesses. In courtrooms, defense attorneys are under no moral obligation to help the prosecution with its case. If the prosecutor doesn't ask the right questions, then the truth may remain hidden. Deception is also an essential part of most sports. In football, quarterbacks try to hide the ball. My wife once said to me, "How can you watch a game where they actually hide the ball?" And coaches devise trick plays intended to give them an advantage. Every basketball player, by the time he reaches high school, knows how to fake an opponent off his feet, his or her feet, in order to get an open shot. Poker, chess, bridge, and checker players have to become adept at hiding their emotions if they're going to be successful. Having examined the top-down theory, let's now take a look at Nyberg's bottom-up theory. He rejects much of the absolutist truth-telling imperative as deceptively simple, and he says, quote, "It sounds not merely possible, but positively easy. Give plain and frank expressions to what is in your mind. Don't misrepresent your thoughts or feelings. But should we really refrain from lying to a violent criminal simply because there may be a truthful alternative? Should we answer a child's every question about sex, divorce, death, and disease, regardless of any possibly disturbing, even destructive consequences of doing so? Should we give frank expression to every strong feeling of contempt, envy, lust, and self-pity? Should we tell our friends the truth when we believe it will shatter their self-confidence? The list of exceptions is endless," end quote. As an alternative, he suggests that we evaluate the inclination to deceive in each instance and determine its moral status in the particular circumstances given. Some people might refer to this as situational ethics, but the label does the theory an injustice, in my opinion. Situational ethics implies that one may become unethical given the correct confluence of circumstances. Bottom-up theory, however, states that each of us carries with us a set of moral values, which sometimes conflict with one another and demand exceptions. Truth-telling is a value, but so are things like kindness, compassion, self-regard, privacy, survival, etc. Which values become victims and which become victors depends upon the circumstances. Nyberg does take some troubling stances for someone who, such as I, who was taught to, quote, always tell the truth, end quote, and was given examples of truth-telling like George Washington and the cherry tree, which is a complete fabrication, by the way. Ironically, written by a parson in order to help children learn to tell the truth. Yet most of what Nyberg says makes so much sense that it's hard to ignore. Nyberg argues that nobody tells the truth all the time. Occasionally, there is a lot to lose by telling the truth, and sometimes a lot to be gained by not telling the truth. He states, quote, "We all value the truth, and yet we are all ordinary human deceivers. We neither want to know all the truth nor tell it all. Deception is not so much a plague as it is part of the atmosphere that sustains life," end quote. While accusing us all of being deceivers, he also dismisses Bach's gloomy domino theory and instead says that most people will tell the truth most of the time as a sort of voluntary contribution to society. This coincides nicely with the Mormon belief in the light of Christ that lighteth every man which cometh into the world. In conjunction with the belief that everyone lies, he gives a particular warning to those who believe everything that they are told. He calls this a sort of brain bypass. Having lived in the East for the last 18 years, I'm often amazed at how trusting and unquestioning people in Utah seem to be. I find the warmth, openness, and lack of cynicism delightful and refreshing, but it also helps me understand why white-collar crime seems to be such a problem here. Finally, Nyberg establishes a checklist for evaluating whether a deception is justifiable, and he lists five categories of concern. One, the situation or context, the time or the place. Public and private places each are governed by different sets of rules. Different situations may call for different levels of truthfulness. Two, the actors. There is a difference between, for example, people helping to hide Jewish refugees during World War II and lying about it to the Nazis, and a spouse lying to his or her mate about an extramarital affair. The relationship between the parties involved is important in determining how much truth should be divulged. Three, the purpose. Why is this happening? Does the deceiver have a clear and fully conscious purpose? Does he or she have a good reason for the deception? Four, the manner. how is this thing being done? Is the deceiver doing things in the most appropriate manner? What is the cost of doing things this way? And fifth, the consequences. How interested should I be? Is the situation trivial or important, joking or serious? And then finally, he points out that there are a few limits to the obligations to tell the truth, including people should avoid harming others. People should help others when they can. And when there is a choice, we should put people before things. Having built an admittedly secular philosophical basis for understanding justifiable deception, let's now turn to some of my original questions. Is it justifiable for a prophet or an apostle to lie? Are there special ramifications that must be considered that are exclusive to their status as religious leaders? Would God lie, or would he ever sanction a lie? A case study or two from the scriptures in Mormon history can be helpful in answering these questions. The story involving a prophet and deception is told in the book of Genesis and involves Abraham and his wife Sarah. In chapter 12, Jehovah promises Abraham that he and his wife will become a great nation. This is the Abrahamic covenant, wherein he was blessed and all families of the earth were to be blessed through him. At the time of the promise, Abraham and Sarah have no children. Soon after the promise is made, a famine comes upon the land, and Abraham and his family travel to Egypt in order to survive. He becomes afraid, as they approach the Egyptian border, that some Egyptians will see Sarah and, because of her great beauty, kill him and take her. To prevent this, he tells Sarah to say that she is his sister. The ruse works, but has unintended consequences. Pharaoh's sons see Sarah and decide that she would be a wonderful addition to their father's harem. They take Sarah and give gifts to Abraham as compensation. In order to protect the sanctity and fidelity of Sarah and Abraham's marriage, and in order to preserve the covenant, his covenant with them, the Lord intervenes. He curses Pharaoh and his house with a great plague. Somehow Pharaoh realizes that it is because of Sarah that the plagues have come, and he discovers Sarah and Abraham's deception. Pharaoh sends for Abraham and scolds him with accusing questions, to which Abraham offers no defense. Finally, Pharaoh orders his men to take Abraham and Sarah and escort them out of Egypt, the ancient equivalent of being deported by the INS. That the story is an important one is evidenced by the fact that it occurs not once, but three times in Genesis. In chapter 20, Egypt is replaced by Gerar, and Pharaoh is replaced by Abimelech, but the other details remain basically the same. God's intervention this time comes in the form of a dream. A dialogue then occurs between Abimelech and Abraham, in which Abraham, this time, defends his actions. He explains that Sarah is his sister, actually his half-sister. This moves the deception from type 1, straightforward lying, to being a type 4, hiding the truth kind of deception. After all, I mean, who would have suspected that she was both his wife and his sister? Abraham also offers the defense that he thought, quote, the fear of God was not in this place, end quote. The irony of his statement lies in the fact that it is Abimelech's respect for Abraham's God that actually saves them. Finally, the story is repeated a third time in chapter 26, with Isaac and Rebekah replacing Abraham and Sarah, but all the other story elements remain virtually unchanged. Was Abraham a prophet justified in lying to Pharaoh? Looking at the results, one can argue that he was. His life and that of his wife were spared. He was in an impossible situation, facing death by starvation on the one side and death at the hand of the Egyptians on the other. Could he have found a more truthful way to save his life? Well, there's no way for me standing here to know. Let's analyze it using bottom-up theory. Given the situation, possible starvation, the actors, a prophet, his family, and people they feared and considered to be their ruthless enemies, and their purpose, to survive long enough to see God's promise fulfilled, one can easily excuse the manner in which the deception was done. However, were it not for God's direct intervention, the consequences of the deceit would have been disastrous, and great harm would have been done, not only to Sarah and Abraham, but to all the nations of the earth. The story from Genesis 12 can be found in one other location, and that is the second chapter of the book of Abraham and the Pearl of Great Price. As translated by Joseph Smith, this version has the Lord specifically telling Abraham to lie to the Egyptians. Abraham is therefore completely justified in the deception since he is simply being obedient. But the idea that God would command a prophet to lie is significant. It reminds me of God's commandment to Nephi to slay Laban in order to obtain the brass plates and thereby prevent an entire nation from perishing in unbelief. Both situations seem justifiable according to bottom-up theory, but for the believing, no theory at all is needed to justify their actions. Only faith is required. From the 1830s to the 1900s, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was involved in the practice of polygamy. For only 10 of those years was a practice both openly and without the sanctions imposed by a disapproving government. From the 1830s until 1852, polygamy was practiced in secret. After Wilford Woodruff issued his manifesto in 1890, polygamy was again practiced in secret until 1904, when officially sanctioned post-manifesto polygamous marriages were stopped by then-President Joseph F. Smith. That polygamy was practiced in secret and that deceptive means were used to hide the practice cannot be disputed. It has been well documented by authors and historians such as Michael Quinn, B. Carmen Hardy, and Richard Van Wagener, to name a few. My question is simply this: were the lies and deceptions that accommodated polygamy justifiable? To answer this question, let me start with Joseph Smith, where the Latter-day Saint practice of polygamy began. There are a few things we need to keep in mind. First, Joseph Smith was a prophet of God whose mission was to restore all things. As part of that restoration, he introduced the practice of plural marriage. While some contradictory evidence exists, early Mormon history is full of statements indicating that the practice of polygamy was a prerequisite to attaining salvation in the highest glory of the celestial kingdom. This was no small commandment. And while many of Joseph's contemporaries struggled with the concept of plural marriage, most also believed that the practice was a direct commandment of God. Second, the early Mormons were a millennial society that believed in the second coming of Christ, that believed that the second coming of Christ was imminent, but could not occur until after the restoration of all things. Plural marriage being a part of that restoration was essential. Third, Mormons at that time firmly believed that the forces of the devil were at work to prevent the restoration from occurring. It's impossible for us to understand the deception that surrounded polygamy unless one recognizes and accepts that the people involved believed that they were simply obeying the commandments of God and fighting against the devil and his forces. In the History of the Church, Volume 5, can be found a quote from Joseph Smith in which he rejects absolutist ethics and sounds a lot like a bottom-up theory practitioner. Quote, "That which is wrong under one circumstance may be and often is right under another. God said, 'Thou shalt not kill,' at one time, he said, and at another time he said, 'Thou shalt utterly destroy.' This is the principle on which the government of heaven is conducted, by revelation adapted to the circumstances in which the children of the kingdom are placed. Whatever God requires is right, no matter what it is, although we may not see the reason therefore till long after the events transpire. But in obedience there is joy and peace unspotted." End quote. Joseph Smith taught, believed in, and practiced deception with regard to plural marriage. If, like Abraham, he was commanded to be deceptive, justified by the absolutist, he was justified in the deception with regard. I lost my place. He was justified, but the absolutist concerns about the consequences of that deceit cannot be ignored. They reverberated through the church for decades and can still be felt. In 1890, Wilford Woodruff issued the Manifesto on Polygamy. Although it is included in the Doctrine and Covenants as Official Declaration 1, it was not originally written as a declaration to the members of the church, but was a communication sent to Washington to aid in convincing the United States government that the practice of polygamy was finally and completely being abandoned. On many levels, the document was intended to be deceptive. It contained truths and half-truths. There were statements in it that it were intended to cause the politicians in Washington to acquire a false belief regarding the truth, and other statements intended to help them stop believing things which were true. Again, it's beyond the scope of this presentation to detail those deceptions, but I will look at whether the deception was justifiable. Let's examine the manifesto using bottom-up theory's five categories. One, what was the situation? The church was under attack from its enemies. Its properties were being escheated, and the temples would soon be confiscated as well. The United States Supreme Court had ruled against the church on all of its appeals. Mormons, even non-polygamous Mormons, were facing the loss of their right to vote, and Mormons were starting to lose control of the local government for the first time. The church's treasury was nearly empty. Giving up polygamy wasn't possible without a commandment from God. Continuing the fight was now also virtually impossible. Second, who were the actors? Well, the saints, who were trying to keep the commandments of God, including the practice of plural marriage, and the United States government, which the saints viewed as an enemy and servant of the devil. Third, the purpose. The purpose was to end the onslaught of anti-polygamy legislation, to protect and preserve the temples, and to keep the church from being destroyed. An official declaration encouraging church members to obey the laws of the land seemed like a possible way to bring a temporary peace. Most of the debilitating anti-polygamy laws that had been passed by the government applied only to the territories, and Wilford Woodruff's intent was to pacify the government long enough for statehood to be granted. Once the saints took back control of the local government, they hoped they could quietly continue the practice through lax enforcement of federal laws. Fourth, the manner. We know that the decision to issue the manifesto was done prayerfully and after great struggle. We know that it was carefully drafted and reviewed by three apostles. We can question why it wasn't presented to the entire quorum and why it was signed by only the president, but there is a little question that he felt inspired by God to issue it. Another example of a prophet of God being inspired to lie. Fifth, the consequences. Statements similar to the manifesto had been made before, but the manifesto was the first official declaration. It is difficult to say that those people involved understood. It's difficult to say what those people involved understood to be the consequences at that time. Officially and publicly ending the practice of practice while secretly continuing to practice polygamy by exploiting the manifesto's loopholes was as dangerous a decision as Abraham's decision to pass off his wife as his sister. Apostle John Henry Smith reportedly said that the manifesto was, quote, but a trick to defeat the devil at his own game, end quote. Playing high-stakes poker with the devil isn't a game I think I would want to play. Although many were shocked and dismayed by the announcement, during the months that followed, more and more members of the church came to accept the manifesto as a revelation and as the will of God. I wonder if Wilford Woodruff and the apostles felt like Abraham must have felt when Sarah was in Pharaoh's harem and all he could do was hope and pray for divine intervention. Considering the existing situation, the participants, the purpose, the manner in which the manifesto was issued, and the expected consequences, I would have to say that, at least in my opinion, the Woodruff Manifesto was a justifiable deception. President Woodruff maintained from the beginning that he had been inspired to issue the manifesto, so he certainly would have felt justified. In retrospect, however, and I recognize that I have a great time and distance from which to judge, I have to ask if it was justifiable given the unexpected consequences. It's difficult to fault them for choosing such a difficult path and in such a dire situation, but there are a few things that they might have anticipated. Perhaps they should have guessed that the government wouldn't accept the manifesto as binding unless it was presented to a general conference and accepted by the members of the church. Perhaps they should have anticipated that most Mormons would believe the manifesto to be the will of God, a revelation from God, to stop the practice of polygamy. Maybe they should have thought a little harder about how divisive it would be to secretly practice polygamy while publicly denouncing it, not only to the government, but to their own members. Prior to the manifesto, the Mormon community was united in its efforts to practice polygamy, and while they were deceptive, they uniformly believed that they had the backing and support of God and the church. That unity became divisiveness as the members of the church and even the quorum of the 12 apostles split on the issue of continued plural marriage. It is the first test. If the first test in deciding whether to or not to deceive is to do no harm, then the manifesto, or more precisely, the practice of post-manifesto polygamy, failed miserably. The thousands of children that were forced to lie to protect their parents' continued practice of polygamy were certainly harmed. The members that moved to Mexico and Canada to enter into the new plural marriages and later became pariahs, unwelcomed by the main body of the church, were also harmed. The Mormons, both leaders and rank-and-file members, that went to Washington during the Reed-Smoot hearings and lied to Congress, were harmed. Apostle John Taylor and Matthias Cowley, who were forced to resign from the Quorum of the Twelve, were harmed. And most importantly, the trust that the members had in each other and in their leaders was harmed. In a religious society such as Mormonism, the statements of religious leaders are given more weight than those of an ordinary member. There is a strong desire upon the part of almost all members to believe that their leaders, to believe what their leaders tell them. We expect a higher level of integrity from them, integrity being a consistency between the actions, words, thoughts, and emotions of the public persona and the private persona. When someone we trust, someone like a leader we are predisposed to believe, lies to us, we are more likely to believe that lie. Even if it makes no sense to us, we may suspend our disbelief, engage in self-deception, and believe it anyway. If we later discover that what we believe to be true is in fact a lie, then that trust has been damaged, and our faith in the integrity of that person is also damaged, even when the lie was intended to be good. For a religious leader, doing the right thing may not be enough. They also have to appear to be doing the right thing. That's why we all pay close attention when a Steve Benson accuses a Dallin Oaks of lying. Elder Oaks may have been deceptive in order to protect his friend and colleague Boyd K. Packer, and given his situation, he may have been doing what he considered not only excusable, but absolutely justifiable. But when the public discovers that they have been deceived, then the integrity of the deceiver is called into question. Paul Dunn, for example, is an emeritus general authority today not because he deceived us when he presented fictional tales as actual events and placed himself in the middle of other people's stories, but he's an emeritus general authority because he got caught deceiving us and his integrity became a question mark. With apologies to Shakespeare, perhaps the fault lies not in our leaders but in ourselves as followers. We tend to forget that past and present prophets and apostles are not only men of God, but also very human and subject to making human mistakes. We forget the psalmist's warning that, quote, all are deceivers, end quote. Telling the truth is a good thing, but knowing how much truth to tell to whom and upon what occasion is a better thing. If our leaders don't tell us all the truth all the time, they may be doing us a favor. That is, as long as we don't find out about it. And perhaps that reason more than any other is why they discourage research into Mormon history and and attendance at symposia. What we really should demand from our leaders and from ourselves is not truth, but trust. Trust is a confidence in or reliance on some quality or attribute of a person. You trust a friend, for example, to look after your best interests. You trust a friend to tell you the truth when you need to hear it, even if the truth hurts. You trust a friend to show discretion, which is tact with regard to the truth. Trusting a person to look after your best interests is different than trusting a person not to deceive you. Our leaders can be forgiven for occasionally deceiving us if they don't violate our trust. Trust, to quote Bach, is a social good to be protected, just as much as the air we breathe or the water we drink. When it is damaged, the community as a whole suffers. And when it is destroyed, societies falter and collapse. To maintain that trust, we need to know that our leaders have our best interests in mind. We need to know that they value our individual needs and not just the needs of the institution. We need to know that they believe that the people below them are as important as those above them or to the side of them. When we know and believe that, then we can place our trust in them the same way we place our trust in a loving and caring God.
I really enjoyed this paper. It presents I think a very difficult question and a difficult experience in human behavior, and analyzes it extremely well. And he had, for the time, for the reason of time constraints, to cut out some personal anecdotes that I thought were really fine, and I appreciated those stories that he had included as well. I think that as you listen to the paper, you sense that underlying or infusing most of the discussion, including the quotes and the presentation, were public policy issues and also questions of ethics. And those are issues that we all struggle with. And then the ethics involves personal ethics that not only affects public policy life but affects the relationship between individuals, which he also stressed. But what I'd like to emphasize in my remarks are things that were he touched on briefly, alluded to, mentioned by indirection, but I think need to be brought to the forefront of the discussion. All of us, in one way or another, have been damaged by deception. I don't think any one of us would dispute that, whether that's deceptions in public policy issues or deceptions in our personal relationships with other people. But all of us also have engaged in deception. And that's something I want to discuss because it, in a way, undermines much of the thrust of the paper. And that is the paper deals with intellectual inquiry about public policy issue, about faith issues, and about ethical issues. And deception, and in fact lying as a subcategory of deception, is precognitive. And it precedes issues of ethics, and it precedes issues of faith. And that's why it is, I think, such a major problem in human experience. As a father of four very different and wonderful children, I learned by observation and experience that one of the first words a child learns to say is no. And when a child says that word, it's for protection in two different directions. One, to protect its independence, and another, protect itself from consequences that child does not want to experience. And the protective nature of lying is precognitive. It doesn't involve ethics. It doesn't involve issues of faith. Those are things that a child is taught. A child is taught to have a sense of ethics. A child is taught to have a sense of faith. And that grows as each of us develops in maturity and experience. But lying is self-preservation. It's something we don't even learn to do. We just do as a precognitive act. And almost the entire balance of our lives is involved in either issues of faith or issues of ethics, trying to sidestep or trying to divert our gut-level response to lie for self-preservation. And that, of course, affects relations with others. It affects public policy issues as leaders in various public institutions also have to deal with that same knee-jerk or precognitive need of self-preservation that involves lying. Another side of the issue that he didn't, I don't think, present, although he touched on it, is that there is a difference between the 19th century leadership of the LDS Church and the 20th century leadership of the LDS Church that is crucial. He touched on a characteristic of the 19th century leadership of the church when he quoted Joseph Smith's what's called his essay on happiness. And that is that theocratic ethics, which is a term that I coined when I was talking about the post-manifesto experience, governed 19th century Mormon leaders. It does not govern 20th century Mormon leaders. 20th century leaders do not have a theocratic worldview. 20th century LDS leaders, whether we're looking at Boyd K. Packer or Dallin Oaks or your stake president or bishop have been secularized to deal with the kinds of expectations and controversies that Sisala Bach and Nyberg discuss. 19th century Mormon leaders had a worldview that really was the worldview that Joseph Smith expressed in that essay on happiness. Whatever God requires is right no matter what. And they struggled with that because they had the normative values of an ethical society, of the value of truth and the value of truth-telling and the condemnations of lies. But in addition to the precognitive experience that all humans have of lying for self-preservation, 19th century Mormon leaders had this theocratic worldview that whatever God requires is right, and whatever is necessary to protect God's requirements is also right. The 20th century hierarchy does not have that perception. They've been secularized. And that creates a very different experience. A Dallin Oaks or a stake president who engages in various kinds of deception does so in a manner very similar to any other public policy leader, whether it's in a school, in a government, wherever. That was different in the 19th century. A Wilford Woodruff, Matthias Cowley, a Joseph Smith had a theocratic worldview which separated them in a very real way from the normative ethical expectations of society. I only throw those out as additional things to think about, because I think that Clay's paper has really presented the quandaries that are involved in this issue of truth-telling and the issue of deception. And neither of the intellectual sources that he quoted was totally happy with the resolution that they offered for these issues of truth-telling and deception. And the paper is a disturbing paper because it provides, even within a secular framework, the problems involved in both truth-telling and in deception. And I simply, as my added comments, point out that those problems are complicated even further by these precognitive issues and the distinction that Mormons have, that in the 19th century there was a theocratic worldview that shaped Mormonism in a different way than is the case today. I don't know that there is a resolution to the kinds of issues that he presented. But as I began, all of us have been damaged by deception. And all of us, if we examine our relations with our children, with our fellow human beings, we have also engaged in deception for whether precognitive, knee-jerk self-preservation or out of a very consciously considered reason that telling the whole truth and nothing but the truth might actually damage the people that we told it to. But we've been engaged in both as victim and victimizer. Thank you.
I think we've all benefited from these challenging papers and comments. I know I've got a lot to go home and think about. Is there anybody here that would like to make a comment? Yes. Would you like to come up and be brief in your comments and speak into the microphone so it'll get on the tape recorder?
I'll try and be brief.
Okay.
Joseph Smith once said that a man was only a prophet when he was acting in that office. I believe there was a certain amount of self-deception in certain areas. He was but a man, even though he acted at times as a prophet. For example, before 1841, he did not believe in marriage after death. That's clear in his letters to Emma. He said, till death do us part, or words to that effect. I also believe that by their fruits shall you know them, and that when we play high-stakes poker with the devil, we set a precedent, and we look at the fruits of that. Isaiah talks about making a covenant with death, and that is when you lack faith and you make a deal with the world. The church made a deal in order to preserve its property and assets. It didn't have sufficient faith to not make a deal with the devil. I see this as setting a precedent maybe in this day and age where we may make a deal with the devil because we do not have sufficient faith. And this is a recurring problem. DNC 112 says that the destruction will happen right here in the church. And I believe it is because of that precedent that was set long ago to make a deal with the devil, which is known as the covenant of death in Isaiah. There are consequences to our secularization, possibly leading to the church telling us to take the mark of the beast, i.e. the computer chip. And that's basically my...
I know that there are lots of ethical considerations that we have to deal with that you've pointed out in your paper. And I can't go back to the 19th century and second-guess people then. I can't get into that mindset. But I have a mindset today that tells me that when church leaders continue to lie about our past, that's morally wrong. And that you cannot have a morally correct church institution that is built on lying. And what I see as extremely destructive in the continuation of lying today is that I see the lying as self-serving to preserve the power of church leaders rather than being motivated by some noble intent to preserve our well-being. And this is what you talked about. We need to be able to trust our leaders to have our interest in mind, but I see them having only institutional interests in mind. And when they do that, I can't trust anything they say to me. Not only can I not trust the kinds of things that deal with Mormonism's past and our past history, but I can't even trust them when they express their faith. And I think that's extremely damaging, and I think they really need to come clean and tell the truth, and I'd like your comments on that.
The non-historian is going to take the first shot at this. I'd like to say that I have spent a lot of time trying to think about that. I did a talk once before about correlation, and correlation has gone through the process of eliminating a lot of things that used to be taught in our church. History in particular has disappeared. I mean, history is not taught with any sort of authority or in-depth analysis at all in the church anymore. But the reason that I believe that happens is one, that a lot of things used to be taught in the church which our leaders simply don't know if they were true or not, that were speculative. And a classic example seems to be happening in the last few weeks. Gordon B. Hinckley has now on two separate occasions said that he's not sure that the quote-unquote couplet where Joseph Smith and the Smith said in the King Follett Doctrines that God was once a man, he doesn't know if that's true or not. He's backed away from that. Well, this is an example of, I believe, Gordon B. Hinckley being absolutely truthful to what he believes, but it's making certain members apoplectic. I've been on the internet and I've seen how many people are really upset by dishonesty because they believe every word ever uttered by Joseph Smith. And that's why I made my comment, you know, that we have to be careful not to believe everything that we're told. On the other hand, I believe that our leaders also think that there are certain things which, though true, can be damaging to testimony.
And there's a moral quandary there. Are they protecting us by hiding the truth, or are they protecting fragile testimonies, testimonies of people who are investigating the church by hiding the truth? Or should it all be out there where we can look at it and examine it and make it for ourselves? I prefer the latter approach, but I think most of our leaders seem to believe that testimony is too fragile a thing and that they seem to feel that they need to protect us from the truth. I don't agree with it, but that's, but I understand it.
Despite my own disagreements on issues of the writing of and discussion of Mormon history, as well as the role of open forums, not only here but at Brigham Young University, I must affirm, and I think I have on other occasions, that the leaders of the church, the First Presidency, the Quorum of the Twelve, which have set these guidelines and policies and have set this direction, are, in my view, not motivated by despicable self-preservation or even institutional preservation motives. They honestly are concerned for the welfare of Latter-day Saints. They have seen and have been and have counseled with and have had reported to them instances of teenagers, young adults, even older members of the church whose testimonies have been devastated, whose loyalty to the church has been damaged as an institution, but whose family life has even been disrupted because they learned uncomfortable truths about Mormon history, or because discussions of the kind that we're even having here have upset their sense of balance spiritually. And the leaders of the church are anxious to protect not just teenagers, but people of all backgrounds, convert, longtime generational Mormons of various ages, from that kind of experience. And I really must, from my own experience with them, and it's been fairly close over a number of years, affirm that that is their motivation. I think that the consequences of trying to feed only milk to members of the church that they continue to regard as vulnerable infants, there are negative consequences to that, and I've stated that. But in response to the observation and the question, I really do see the leaders of the church motivated by a sense of concern, protectiveness, and love for the membership. And we may disagree with what they've done, and we may see our own consequences, but they're responding to another set of priorities and another set of consequences that very often have been reported to them.
Gosh, I don't know what to do. This is one of my favorite topics, but we're 5 minutes over time. As far as I'm concerned, I guess the tape's off. I don't know what, but as far as I'm concerned, we can go on talking until they kick us out.
Sure.
I was just trying to imagine what Mark Twain might say if he were here today. And I thought he might refer to the lie as a high and holy, as having a high and holy purpose as an instrument of truth. Whether it be the deception that God did on Adam and Eve by giving them two conflicting commandments, giving them a badly needed test motivated by love and their need for growth, or whether it's a bald-faced, cruel, angry, shooting yourself in the foot kind of a lie from the people who produced the God Makers and accused President Hinckley of being involved in sex orgies, which stimulates our curiosity to learn more and to get ourselves closer to the truth.
I'm sorry we're 5 minutes, well, we're more than 5 minutes over time. I wish we could go on. Actually, Clay just told me that he and Mike would be glad to stay and answer questions and talk with you further, but I'm afraid we've got to let the other people come in for the next session. Thank you very much, both of you, for your wonderful presentation.